a nazr, a vow, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I'm a person suffering from backbiting, during the holy month of Ramadan, I practice that, but then I need a long program after the holy month of Ramadan. After the morning prayer, I say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will not backbite at all, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If I do that, I make a vow that for each backbiting, for example, I will fast for one day, or for example, I will pay $10 in charity. During the day, I will do muraqabah. At night, when I think about our actions, for example, I come to see that I have backbitten, for example, once. So I need to fast the following day because of the nab.
Right.
It would be pretty difficult. So the next day, I would be more careful about my action.
Right.
Of course, the vow should be in a moderate way. For example, I shouldn't say that I will fast for 2 months if I backbite once, or I will pay $10 in charity. It should be something in a moderate way. So gradually, this program of musharata, muraqaba, muhasaba will, help
us, inshallah, to
keep the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan.
Are we done with this question, Sheikh?
Yes.
One more thing I think is good to be added to this, and inshallah, finalize the discussion. I think we have some days in a month, except the holy month of Ramadan, that are recommended to be fasting on those days. Again,
exactly.
I think if we keep fasting, for example, 3 days a month,
that's
or at least 1 day per month, it is also another good connection with this holy month.
Yes.
Thank you, dear Sheikh, for your answers and these scholarly answers to the questions and enlightening answers which were given to the questions by you. And you, respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن علي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
The Subcontinent. Hi everyone, this is your host John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organization, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We'll try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent ceasefire agreement between India and Pakistan that has brought back relative peace along the disputed border areas. Then we will explore the reverberations of the New Deal in the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries, as well as its numerous repercussions for the geopolitical future of Asia.
India and Pakistan have recently issued a joint statement to announce that they will strictly observe all of their agreements on ceasefire along the so-called line of control and other disputed areas. This was the first joint statement in nearly 20 years. Historically, whenever ceasefires are announced via different statements, they tend to fail. But a joint statement by both militaries is a proof that the deal is a result of back-channel negotiations and may have a better chance to last. Should it hold, the new agreement may be a big deal for India and Pakistan, and arguably for the whole world.
The recent India-Pakistan ceasefire agreement along the so-called line of control has brought relative calm to border areas, which were the scenes of bloody conflicts for much of the 2020 well into this year. After over a decade of fighting since their last similar deal, the Director Generals of Military Operations of the two nations issued a rare joint statement that put into effect the cessation of hostilities since late February. The generals said from now on they want to address each other's core issues and concerns, and also envisage pullback of specialized forces that are stationed for trans-border offensive maneuvers and operations. Since their Great Partition, Islamabad and New Delhi have been caught in a vicious circle that has been deadly and devastating, and have come up with numerous agreements with limited longevity. But the New Deal is reported to be the result of many rounds of high-level back-channel negotiations away from the public eye, and probably many politicians. Hence, hopes are a little higher. However, their flimsy communication hotline is still in a nascent stage, and only a test of time will tell if it has the potential to create a lasting peace between the two nuclear-armed countries.
Weeks after India and Pakistan agreed on quote-unquote strict observance of the 2003 ceasefire, the pact continues to be followed on the ground with no apparent signs of violation. With the renewal of their commitment to nearly two-decade-old ceasefire along the border, the winds of change are blowing in relations of the two. But are they strong enough to turn the tide in the deep sea of distrust between the two classic adversaries?
India and Pakistan, along with other nations in South Asia, are members of a subcontinental civilizational family tied together by bonds of shared culture, religion, race and language. The fathers of Pakistan and India wanted them to live in peace, not in permanent conflict. Mahatma Gandhi had the audacity to publicly call both India and Pakistan as his country. Although geographically and politically India is divided in two, at heart we shall be friends and brothers, helping and respecting one another and be one for the outside world, Gandhi famously said on January 26, 1948, just 4 days before his assassination at the hands of a Hindu extremist. Muhammad Ali Jinnah also desired good and neighborly relations, something he described as an association similar to that between the US and Canada. The ceasefire accord heralds a new era of Indo-Pak ties, but only if it can withstand the likely setbacks along the way. There are multitudes of concurring or conflicting forces, both in support and opposition of the new momentum for peace, from inside the two countries, militaries, parliaments or administrations, along with regional and international players with some stake in the game.
If there is a peace, of course, the whole region will enjoy, the whole region will develop, the whole region will welcome. Against this, if there is any confrontation, because India and Pakistan both are the nuclear states and they have the capabilities to destroy each other completely, that will be disaster not only for India and Pakistan but for the whole region. The peace is only hope, and the hope for the Asia, for the whole region. I believe that all other countries in the Asia, they will appreciate and they will like it.
The timing of the newly achieved agreement was the source of a lot of contentious speculations in itself. It happened after months of secret talks, but suspiciously around at the same time India reached a somehow similar deal with China. This has caused many to question Beijing's role during the back-channel meetings. Another touchy subject purportedly linked to the ceasefire is the election of Joe Biden into the White House. Many argue that if Donald Trump had managed to stay in office, such an agreement would never have been clinched.
Given the hype in expectations and the special discourse and circumstances around the ceasefire, the agreement seems more than a strategic maneuver or a solitary move, with the impression that it is only the first step in a longer peace process. The announcement could not have emerged without top-notch diplomatic work by the two governments, and probably with some help from others. the influence of Beijing on the deal or where China stands in this complex geopolitical equation has remained unclear, but the timing of the agreement indicates a high correlation as the Indo-Pak deal was publicized following another Himalayan de-escalation effort in the India-China border areas. In any conceivable scenario, the future of the new treaty will be intertwined with the dynamics of the two countries' relations with China. Another external factor with considerable weight on the ceasefire can be the new US administration. India wants China contained but does not want to do the job itself. When Donald Trump was in office, Premier Narendra Modi was certain of Washington's harsh approach towards Beijing. But with Joe Biden at the helm, India needs new tactics to control the extent of interactions between its two main rivals, Pakistan and China.
Washington is far away from this region, and we do not know how much interest they have in the peace in this region. But of course, they are close allied with India. They are bound in Quad alliance with Japan, Australia, India, and America. They, of course, are very much concerned about India. About Pakistan, we were close allied with the Western world during the Cold War, but since for last couple of decades, Washington was keeping distance from Pakistan and tilting toward India more and more.
Last year was the worst year since the 2003 ceasefire, as the two armies recorded about 5,000 bouts of skirmishes in border areas. But worst year for whom? Many of the killed or injured people are not even from the two countries' militaries. Most of them are the innocent inhabitants of the border villages stuck in a decades-long political conundrum, mainly over Kashmir. Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the Kashmir issue as their only real problem. But can this new deal solve the issue of Kashmir forever?
Since their independence from British colonial rule in 1947, India and Pakistan have fought many wars, with regular fatal scuffles across the tumultuous borders. Almost all the efforts to bring peace and normalcy have crumbled with no breakthrough, mostly due to their irreconcilable positions on Kashmir. The Indian government abrogated the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, making the would-be independent Kashmir a federally controlled territory. For Islamabad, Kashmir is essential to the idea of Pakistan's creation, and any acceptance of the new status quo is bound to be seen as letting down the Kashmir cause. Unless India and Pakistan reach an understanding on the way forward in their Kashmir policies, the people of Kashmir will be the actual sufferers of the new diplomatic feat. Any future for the virtually non-existent bilateral relationship between India and Pakistan is only imaginable if they find a solution for Kashmir. A united Asia is only possible with a balanced triangle of power among China, India and Pakistan, in addition to close cooperation with other powerhouses like Russia and Iran. This is not a reality yet, not until a solution is found for Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Ravi Nitesh. He's a social activist and the founder of Aghaz-e-Dosti. Mr. Nitesh, welcome to the show. So, there have been ceasefires throughout the history between India and Pakistan. Do you think this one would beg to differ and last?
Actually, what we see that first of all, this ceasefire pact that happened between the DGMOs of India and Pakistan is definitely a positive step. Whether it is different from the past or not is a separate question, because this is not the first ceasefire pact. Actually, ceasefire goes into the history since 1949, when the ceasefire line was drawn between India and Pakistan, and it followed in 1972 Simla agreement, when the ceasefire line converted into line of control. And even after that, when in 1999 the Kargil conflict happened between India and Pakistan, then the ceasefire violations goes up to very high level. And even after that, in 2003, there was a ceasefire agreement between the government of India and government of Pakistan. And after the 2003 ceasefire agreement, there is a drastic lowering down of ceasefire violations incidents. If you will see the numbers, you will find that in 2002, there were more than 8,000 ceasefire violations happened in 1 year. While after the agreement happened between government of India and Pakistan at the time of Vajpayee and Musharraf, so at that time, in 2004, it drastically goes to nil. And then again, from the 2003 to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, it goes to normal. And after 2012-13, it again started increasing. 2013, there was again a DGMO ceasefire promise that they will follow the ceasefire. 2018, again DGMOs promised each other that they will follow the ceasefire. And now it is 2021. Because this year, if we will see 2020, there were more than 5,100 ceasefire violations. And when it comes to the human cost, it is huge and huge. So what I see, that this is definitely a positive step, but frankly I don't see that it is very different from the historical ceasefire agreements that happened in the past, but always denied and violated.
Alright, so you think that it's a positive step, but it won't make much difference. So moving ahead, Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the issue of Kashmir as their only real problem. Can this new deal solve the issues in Kashmir?
No, I definitely don't think that this new deal can solve the problem. But definitely, if there are ceasefire violations, then it is means very highlighted issue on both the sides. And if the local population will be affected and the local environment will be unstable, then definitely there can be no other talks. So if ceasefire agreement has happened, even if between the DGMOs, which is only army sites on both the sides, it's army ranks DGMOs, and when DGMO agreed that ceasefire will be observed, then definitely the government's diplomatic and political channels can become active to talk on other issues, including the Kashmir. Because Kashmir is not the only issue on both the sides. There are many other issues, including Kashmir. So it can help in creating a positive environment to take other CBMs or to talk on other things. Because when we see that there were many CBMs that were taken already on place between both the countries. There were buses going on from India to Pakistan, Pakistan to India. There were trade, there were postal services, but all are stopped. All are stopped. At present, there is no trade, there is no bus going on, there is no postal services. So what we think as a civil society persons, as a people who support the peace and people-to-people relations, that definitely this ceasefire pact brings a positive impact, a positive hope for everyone, and particularly for the people who are living near the borders and in the Jammu and Kashmir area, towards Indian side as well as towards Pakistan side.
All right, Mr. Nitesh, before moving ahead, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look and then we can move forward.
The Director Generals of Military Operations of India and Pakistan held discussions over the established mechanism of hotline contact. The two sides reviewed the situation along the line of control and all other sectors in a free, frank and cordial atmosphere, in the interest of achieving mutually beneficial and sustainable peace along the borders. The two militaries agreed to address each other's core issues and concerns, which have propensity to disturb peace and lead to violence. Both sides reiterated that existing mechanisms of hotline contact and border flag meetings will be utilized to resolve any unforeseen situation or misunderstanding. The 2003 ceasefire came at a time when Pakistan, in the wake of 9/11, was under tremendous pressure from the US to clean up its act. This unwritten ceasefire was preceded by a back-channel process that had begun around 2000. It led to the Musharraf-Vajpayee joint statement, in which Pakistan declared it would not permit any terrorist group to operate in its territory or launch a terrorist attack from its territory on foreign soil. For people living alongside the lock, ceasefire have revived their lives, brought peace and given security after about 10 years of warlike situation prevailing in the border areas. The people in this belt were the main victims of any shelling. Now, the families residing in this area have started social functions and inviting friends and relatives to their houses. The habitats have again got an opportunity of secured life with honor and dignity. It is a fact that ceasefire will provide huge relief to people living in border areas alongside the lock on both sides and open the gates for further steps towards normalcy.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Nitesh. So, if peace can establish between India and Pakistan, will it help create a united Asia?
See, when it comes to united Asia, when if one will see the India and Pakistan, so first of all, they see that it lies in South Asia. And one can see that the South Asian Regional Coordination, that is SAARC. SAARC is almost failed concept. Only because India and Pakistan were not agreed to go hand in hand with each other. Since 2016, there is no meeting of SAARC. Since 2016. And whenever the SAARC meets, there are issues arise of India and Pakistan. There are many other countries. Nepal is there, Bhutan is there, Maldives is there, Sri Lanka is there, Bangladesh is there, Afghanistan is there in the SAARC. But all other issues come went to back foot when it comes to India and Pakistan conflict. So definitely I think if India and Pakistan can go hand in hand, can compromise on each other, can settle their long unresolved disputes, and can observe the ceasefire, can carry the promise of developing a regional coordination and peace, then definitely it can not only help the India and Pakistan, but also the whole South Asia. And because the South Asia region is connected with all other regions like Central Asia, Middle East, Southeast Asia, and all these the Asia region has a huge potential. If they will just coordinate with each other and just cooperate with each other. You see that when it comes to IPI, Iran Pakistan India pipeline, so you see that this pipeline can definitely serve a big goal, a huge purpose of energy needs in Pakistan as well as in India. But it is not happening. It is not. When it comes to China, we see that China is a big country. China is a very big country. And when it comes to China, Pakistan, India, then Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. so Russia. So all these Asian players can definitely, if they will coordinate with each other and cooperate with each other, I must believe that the Asian continent can reach a greater height.
All right, that marks the end of this question answer session. Thank you so much, Mr. Nitesh, for being with us. Viewers, now people have voiced their opinions on social media and cyberspace, so let's just take a quick look at what they think.
Team Bharat wrote on Twitter, Thread India and Pakistan have provided a sigh of relief to their citizens, especially the ones who live right next to the barbed wires marking the line of control. The ceasefire agreement on Indo-Pak border is a positive initiative wholly welcomed by India. Samir P. Lalwani posted on his Twitter, in the last 3 years alone, 341 civilians had died in the border firing that included small arms and artillery shelling. Tara believes step one is to evolve a clear and relatively transparent, clear border management strategy between the two sides. But that means Pakistan giving up terror seems unlikely.
All right, and that was our episode covering the peace deal between India and Pakistan. Thanks.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Hello and greetings. Welcome to our program. I'll be continuing on speaking about our matter, which was talking about Ahkam in month of Ramadan. This is our program, the month of Allah, and I'm happy to be with you to talk to you more about Ramadan. Well, previously, as you know, I was talking about the things that will break your fast. I will continue on that matter because it's not, you know, it's not finished yet. The next thing is throwing up. You know, if you throw up, your fast is broken. The important thing about throwing up is the fact that sometimes it happens to you consciously, because you do it because this is the cure of your illness. It is one of the really, you know, regularly done medicines of some of the illnesses and sicknesses, especially about your stomach, which happens. For example, you have eaten something corrupted, and after that you feel so ill, you go to the doctor. Doctor says that you need to throw up. So intentionally, for example, you put your finger down your throat and you throw up. This specific act cannot be done in month of Ramadan, in that period which you are fasting. But sometimes it happens that you're not doing that. You have eaten something that you didn't know it didn't suit your body, you didn't know it was not compatible with your stomach, and you just threw up. The second thing, which is, you know, not intentionally doing that, it's all right. It doesn't break your fast. Don't be worried about that. But there's something to mind here. The thing is, especially in this month, we need to be more aware of the things that we eat. Are they compatible with our bodies or are they not? Because in the time of fasting, when the morning starts up to the night, we need to be sure that it doesn't make our stomach ill. It doesn't make us throw up. So I'm not going to say that you need to be certain, absolutely 100%, that the thing that I eat is not going to make me throw up. No. But we need to, you know, focus more on it. You need to be regarding them more. We need to mind them more than before, because it's going to ruin our fasting. So it is very good before the month of Ramadan to choose foods, probably cross some of the foods out, and to think about the consequences that they have had on our bodies before the month of Ramadan, because in this month it's going to continue. Our bodies have not changed, And if I, for example, if you have fish and fish is not compatible with a lot of people's stomachs, and they throw up, for example, afterwards because it has a specific smell which is not nice to a lot of people. For example, cross it out simply. In this month, I'm not going to eat that because it makes me ill. It makes me throw up. So if knowingly you eat something that is going to make you throw up, it breaks your fast. But no, unconsciously, you didn't know it. It was not deliberate. You ate something. For example, your mother puts a dish in front of you and said, eat this before the fasting starts. And you were hungry, you ate it. It seemed all right to you, but after a couple of hours when the fasting started, it just made you throw up. It's all right because you did not know that. And when you throw up, you know, food comes out. You need to pour all of the food out into the sink and wash your mouth and be sure that the things that came out are not in your mouth again to swallow. So wash your mouth completely and continue your fasting. It's all right. Thank you very much. Be with us, and we're going to continue our program talking about very important facts about this month, which are the ahkam surrounding it. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The catastrophe unfolding in India appears to be the worst-case scenario that many feared from the COVID-19 pandemic. Unable to find sufficient hospital beds, access to tests, medicines, or oxygen, the country of 1.4 billion is sinking beneath the weight of infections. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Peter Beaumont. The piece is titled, Why India's Worsening COVID Crisis is a Dire Problem for the World. catastrophe unfolding in India appears to be the worst-case scenario that many feared from the COVID-19 pandemic. Unable to find sufficient hospital beds, access to tests, medicines, or oxygen, the country of 1.4 billion is sinking beneath the weight of infections. The two opposed assumptions of the global response to coronavirus, wealthy countries in the West prioritizing vaccines for their own need in one camp, and the argument led by the World Health Organization WHO for global vaccine equality in the other, are also failing to hold as the scale of the crisis in India points to an urgent need to prioritize the response there. With a global supply of vaccines unlikely to pick up until the end of this year, what is required now is international leadership and a recognition that despite the best intentions of the World Health Organization, WHO, and the vaccine-sharing COVAX initiative to fairly distribute jabs, the pandemic may require a period of more focused firefighting, where difficult and sometimes unpopular decisions need to be made. That will require countries to look beyond their own health crises to see that the pandemic could still get much worse without intervention. Experts have repeatedly warned that allowing the virus to circulate unchecked increases the risk that dangerous new strains of the virus will emerge and prolong the pandemic. Models already exist for what could be done, such as the 2014 global response to Ebola in West Africa, which was seen as an international priority. The reality is that the magical thinking displayed by the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government, which claimed the pandemic was in its endgame in March as the country careened towards a second wave of infections, was not much different from the mistakes of other world leaders, including former US President Donald Trump, who famously thought the virus would simply disappear, or the mistaken boosterism of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What is different in India, a country with a fragile healthcare system and even weaker surveillance, is the huge possibility for harm locally and globally, perhaps on a scale not yet seen in the pandemic. India has also dramatized the danger of an atomized approach in the global response to coronavirus. The world's biggest producer of vaccines, the Serum Institute of India, was supposed to supply doses under the COVAX scheme to poorer nations, mostly in Africa. Doses have now been diverted for India's needs, which is itself has struggled to acquire material for vaccine production from the United States. As a consequence of the crisis, this month India shipped just 1.2 million doses of the vaccine abroad, compared with 64 million in the 3 months prior. But what India needs immediately is supplies for its vaccine factories, currently held up by the United States export restrictions, and tools such as genomic sequencing to identify and control existing and emerging variants of the virus. One hopeful sign is that the United States has promised to rapidly deploy aid to healthcare workers in India, where there has been a fourth consecutive day of world record COVID case numbers. The United States said it was in high-level talks to deploy extra help to Indian healthcare workers and that it was gravely concerned about the situation in India. Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, said on Sunday, 25th of April, several measures are being considered, including sending over oxygen supplies, tests, drug treatments, and personal protective equipment, PPE. Bottom line, it's a terrible situation that's going on in India and other lower middle-income countries, and there is more that we can do, Dr. Anthony Fauci said. Meanwhile, India's daily coronavirus death toll passed a new record on Saturday, 24th of April, as the government battled to get oxygen supplies to hospitals overwhelmed by the hundreds of thousands of new daily cases. Queues of COVID-19 patients and their fearful relatives are building up outside hospitals in major Indian cities. The new world pandemic hotspot, which has reported nearly a million new cases in just 3 days. Another 2,624 deaths, a new daily record, were reported in the last 24 hours, taking India's official death toll to nearly 190,000 since the pandemic started. More than 340,000 new cases were also reported, taking India's total to 16.5 million, second only to the United States. But many experts are predicting that the current wave will not peak for at least another 3 weeks, and that the real death toll and case numbers are much higher. Stung by criticism of its lack of preparation ahead of a wave of coronavirus infections, the central government in India has organized special trains to get oxygen supplies to the worst-hit cities. It has also pressed industrialists to increase production of oxygen and life-saving drugs that are in short supply. One Oxygen Express train carrying 30,000 liters of oxygen for hospitals arrived in Lucknow in Uttar Pradesh province at dawn on Saturday, where armed guards were waiting to escort trucks to hospitals. Lucknow has been one of the worst-hit cities in India, with hospitals and crematoriums inundated with patients and bodies. An official said the liquid oxygen would only be enough for half a day's needs. The Indian Air Force is also being used to transport oxygen tankers and other supplies around the country. In New Delhi itself, the city's government said it would begin setting up buffer stocks of oxygen to speed supplies to hospitals when they are within hours of running out. Many patients are dying outside hospitals in the capital, New Delhi, because of the lack of beds and oxygen. One charity has set up an overflow crematorium in a car park, with makeshift funeral pyres built to deal with the mounting deaths.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aqil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I did say that it's divided into different parts. Part one, which alhamdulillah we have now finished explaining and sharing some valuable points about it, was in regards to how one deals with himself, with herself, our relationship with ourselves. In our lives that we have, how do we cater to our own needs and requirements? Entering into part two is how do we deal with other fellow human beings, our relationship with other human beings? What is the reason why people, you know, sever ties and don't, you know, communicate with their relatives, or, you know, cut off any kind of relationship with their kin? It could be dunyawi related matters. You know, he didn't invite me, or she didn't do this to me, or they didn't send him to me, or when the inheritance was being distributed, I didn't get this part. Dunyawi things coming down to hirs, coming down to greed, or it's just a lack of akhlaq, lack of tolerance, lack of simple adab, lack of modesty and chastity when it does come to revering and respecting your elders. You know, your uncle said that to you, so what? Your auntie said that to you, so what? You know, they were angry at the time. They were they don't have that level of iman that you do. Why take yourself to their level? Why bring yourself down? Why allow yourself to commit a major sin by cutting your ties with your relatives? Okay, you want to teach them a lesson, or you want to do this, or you want to do that? Yes, but there are certain ways. Now, what are the forms of you observing kin with your relatives? What are the forms of you connecting and reconnecting? Here, a few of them. عُودُ مَرْضَاهُمْ. Visit them when they're sick. اِشْهَدُ جَنَائِزَهُمْ. Participate in the funeral processions. تَزَاوَرُ. Visit. Find the good opportunities, good events, celebrations, whatnot, and visit each other. لَا صَدَقَ وَذُو رَحِمٍ مُحْتَاج. If you have a relative that's in need, there's no need for you to pay, there's no meaning for you to pay sadaqah to somebody else, as the hadith says. And as we mentioned, صِلُوا أَرْحَمَكُمْ, as Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, صِلُوا أَرْحَمَكُمْ وَلَوْ بِالتَّسْلِيمْ, every month, every 2 months, whenever you can. If you don't have that kind of closeness, they're not as close to you. They might be in another country. They might be in another country. There might be, you know, a drift apart between your family and their family. But Eid day comes, send them a message, send them a salam, and build those bridges back. You be the better person, and you do the khair, irrespective of what's happening with the elders, what's happening with your parents or your grandparents or the relatives and others. You be the best, better person. You do the right thing. And do it based on this. Don't do it based on what other people are telling you. Even if they were non-religious, even if they were non-Muslim, even if they were evil and bad or corrupt or whatnot, you know, whatever it may be. Yes, there are certain times where, no, you know, the boundary is exceeded, you know, that they've crossed that red line. You know, in those kind of very, very, very rare circumstances, the case is different.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدری گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
When we're talking about these normal kind of strifes that we have among families, you know, you need to always be the better person in these kind of cases. And worst case scenario, as the hadith says, أَفْضَلُ مَا تُوصَلُ بِهِ الرَّحِيمُ كَفُّ الْأَذَى عَنْهُمْ. The best way, the best thing that you are able to do in observing your ties with your kin is by you not hurting them, by you not harming them. Don't hurt them. Don't gossip about them. Don't backbite them. Don't say negative things about them. Don't add fuel to the fire. Don't do any of these things. You know, try to always, as I'm saying, be the better person. And of course, there are levels. You know, you have your sababiyya, you have your nasabiyya. You also have your siblings. Then you have your uncles, your paternal, maternal, your first cousins, your second cousins, extended family, people in the same, for example, your clan, your ashira, your tribe, your city, whatnot, whoever it may be. You know, there are those who are going to be closer. You need to observe kin and relationship in more effective way, and then there are those, you know, probably at a lesser grade, you know. But the important thing is that there is that kind of consistency when it does come to making sure that you are never among those who fall under the category of qati'ur rahim, someone who severs ties with their family members. You know, what are the cases or examples of what we are talking about when it comes to family members and kin? Inshallah, we will continue on in the next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.